Welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I am your host, David O. Selznick, and I'm taking charge of this production. Not even a laugh, really?
No, I was chuckling.
I think part of it was just kind of like, oh, what's going on?
Yay! I'm Brandon with the bad humor. You could tell me I'm not funny, it's fine. We've got our wonderful guest, wonderful co-host, Chris Haig. How are you doing, Chris?
It's not Chris Haig, it's me, Joan Fontaine. Can't you tell?
Oh, yes. You
I can't even keep a straight face. I'm good. I'm tired and wired, but definitely inspired. So I'm looking forward to this.
Ooh. And he rhymes. He's a poet and he knows it. Tom is away. He's under the weather. So, alas, We are unable to discuss with him, but we do have our special guest, third time returning guest, Manish Mathur. How are you doing, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing very well. Very excited. Thanks for having me again.
You had specifically requested Rebecca. We had told you a while ago, back when you served your time by doing The Farmer's Wife, and then we gave you carte blanche to choose whatever you wanted, and you chose Rebecca.
That is true. Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this film with you guys.
Excellent. Well, before we get into it, Manish, I just want to ask you, which is better, Rebecca or The Farmer's Wife?
It's a really hard question. You know, Rebecca does, you know, it did win Best Picture, but like, you know, the Academy is, you know, they don't always get it right. So I don't know, but I think I'll have to give the edge to Rebecca just slightly, you know.
Okay, fair enough.
No, I'm kidding. Of course Rebecca is a million times like better.
Yes. I don't know. I think we gave The Farmer's Wife like 2 stars. I definitely did not give Rebecca 2 stars. So
right.
Awesome. I'm actually looking forward to discussing this because you and I spoke, Manish, a while ago, and I had said I didn't really like Rebecca. And I thought it was a long and dry and boring. And I messaged you last night and said my opinion may have changed on this film.
Yeah.
So before I jump, however, into the behind-the-scenes information that I have on the actors, we do want to thank our networks that are hosting us, the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, as well as the Fandom Podcast Network. We greatly appreciate their support. They are wonderful, wonderful people. Chris, do you have a summary for us?
Rebecca is the story of a young woman, unnamed, she never gets a title, who marries a fascinating widow only to find out that she must live in the shadow of his former wife, Rebecca, who died mysteriously several years earlier. The young wife, otherwise known as the second Mrs. De Winter, must come to grips with the terrible secret of her handsome, cold husband, Max De Winter. She must also deal with the jealous, obsessed Mrs. Danvers, the housekeeper, who will not accept her as the mistress of the house.
Also known as the Vulcan Priestess from Star Trek 3.
I know, I only found that out when I was on the comments of like a Rebecca video, and I was just like, oh!
That's funny. Awesome. Yes. Did you know, before I get in the trivia, did you know that Hitchcock like wrote up a screenplay for this and he wanted to call her Daphne?
You know, I remember reading that at some point, and I think it's... I think that's kind of a good way to refer to her, because it's kind of, I guess when a character doesn't really have a name, it's hard to talk about them. Because you don't really, I mean, I usually will just call her like the second Mrs. De Winter, which is kind of a mouthful, but
yeah,
I mean, I think I've read that as well.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah, it's interesting because I watched the Criterion edition of this movie, and there's an hour-long French documentary on Daphne du Maurier. And they talk about it in it that she's almost like Daphne du Maurier is writing about herself almost. Like she's very similar to who Daphne du Maurier was. And like Daphne du Maurier had like fallen in love with the wife of her publisher, Doubleday's. Like I can't remember the name because I just watched the documentary the other day, but Doubleday's wife and her spent a trip back because Daphne du Maurier got sued for plagiarism for this book.
They
like they kind of fell in love on this trip or whatnot. So, and then like there's this story about this woman that she fell in love with as well that like used to be her dad's mistress and all this. And it's a really fascinating documentary on this on the author Daphne du Maurier, and I definitely recommend it. I love Criterion; they always do a great job of picking some wonderful bonus features.
Yeah, I also had the Criterion Blu-ray, and I'm excited to get into that as well.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, let's jump into, I got quite a bit of behind-the-scenes stuff, so if you guys want to jump in at any time on some comments, please feel free. So, Rebecca is a 1940 American romantic psychological thriller directed by Alfred Hitchcock. It was Hitchcock's first American project and his first film under contract with producer David O. Selznick. The screenplay by Robert E. Sherwood and Joan Harrison, and adaptation by Philip MacDonald and Michael Hogan, were based on the 1938 novel of the same name by Daphne du Maurier. The film stars Laurence Olivier as the brooding aristocratic widower Maxim de Winter and Joan Fontaine as the young woman who becomes his second wife, with Judith Anderson, George Sanders, and Gladys Cooper in supporting roles. The film won the Academy Award for Best Picture of 1940, and it's the only film directed by Hitchcock to win that prestigious accolade. In addition to Best Picture, Rebecca also won the award for Best Cinematography out of a total of 11 nominations. The other 9 nominations were Best Director for Alfred Hitchcock, Best Adapted Screenplay for Robert E. Sherwood and Joan Harrison, Best Actor for Laurence Olivier, Best Actress for Joan Fontaine, Best Supporting Actress for Judith Anderson, Best Film Editing for Hal C. Kern, Best Music Original Score by Franz Waxman, Best Art Direction Black and White for Lyle R. Wheeler, and Best Special Effects for Jack Cosgrove and Arthur Johns. Now, I don't have it listed, but for behind-the-scenes stuff here, but I was actually quite floored when I was watching the Criterion bonus features as to how many special effect-type shots there were in this film. So, Manish, have you watched all the bonus features?
No, I haven't. I was really actually thinking about digging into it at some point, but yeah, I'd love to hear more about it.
So a lot of the shots, he would like set up the set and he'd put the camera low so that you could see like the ceiling of the stage production, but then it would be like matted out so that they could put a matte painting there.
Oh, wow.
So like there's scenes when she's walking in the house and the roof part is a matte painting.
Yeah.
And once you see that, you can kind of see it in the film. But if you don't know that it's there, these matte paintings are almost flawless.
Wow.
They talked about the miniatures that they used, and I knew some of them were miniatures. But we'll talk about one of those total Hitchcock shots, and I'll just mention it right now. But when the second Mrs. De Winter is talking with Maxim's sister, there's a special effect shot in that she turns her head and the background goes black, and it's just her face that's lit up. It's a very iconic shot. And how they achieved that shot was actually they filmed the sister and then rear projected it and then filmed Joan Fontaine.
Oh, wow.
In front of it, right? So, like, yeah. Just simple shots like that. Like, are very interesting. This is going to be an interesting movie to talk about because David O. Selznick had his hands so much on it, but there is some really interesting, iconic Hitchcock stuff in it.
Yeah, so. And, like, that's one of my favorite shots in the film, so it's interesting to see, like, how much it took to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really fascinating. So Wikipedia lists the Miami premiere date as March 21st, 1940, with the general release date of April 12th, 1940. Now, we're recording this podcast on September 8th of 2019, and when I was doing my research, I discovered that today is actually the 80th anniversary of the first day of production on Rebecca. So it's kind of interesting that here we are 80 years ago today, Hitchcock started filming. Rebecca was twice honored by the AFI in their AFI 100 Years series. 100 Years, 100 Thrills, this was number 80. And 100 Heroes and Villains, Mrs. Danvers, was number 31. At Selznick's insistence, the film faithfully adapts the plot of Du Maurier's novel Rebecca. However, at least one plot detail was altered to comply with the Hollywood production code, which said that the murder of a spouse had to be punished. In the novel, Maxim shoots Rebecca, while in the film he only thinks of killing her as she taunted him into believing that she was pregnant with another man's child, and her subsequent death is accidental. However, Rebecca was not pregnant but had incurable cancer and had a motive to commit suicide, that of punishing Maxim from beyond the grave. Therefore, her death is declared a suicide, not murder. Hitchcock later said that Selznick wanted the smoke from the burning Manderley to spell out a huge R, which Hitchcock thought lacked subtlety. While Selznick was preoccupied by Gone with the Wind in 1939, Hitchcock was able to replace the smoky R with the burning of a monogram negligee case lying atop a bed pillow. Hitchcock edited the film in camera, which means that he was shooting only what he wanted to see in the final film, to restrict the producer's power to re-edit the picture. But Selznick relished the post-production process, and he personally edited the footage, laid in Franz Waxman's score, and supervised the retakes and extensive re-recording of the dialogue of Sanders, Bates, and Fontaine. Rewrites and reshooting were called for after a rough cut was previewed on December 26, 1939. Although Selznick insisted that the film be faithful to the novel, Hitchcock did make some other changes, though not as many as he had made in a previously rejected screenplay, in which he had altered virtually the entire story. In the novel, Mrs. Danvers is something of a jealous mother figure, and her past is mentioned in the book. But in the film, Mrs. Danvers is a much younger character. Judith Anderson would have been about 42 at the time of shooting, and her past is not revealed at all. The only thing we know about her is that she came to Manderley with Rebecca when Rebecca was a bride. Now, I want to read something here, because we'll probably talk a bit about it. Hitchcock and Selznick had quite a tough time on set working with each other. Like, these guys are both behemoths in their field. And one of the really awesome things that Criterion has included in their liner notes for the Rebecca Blu-ray is a letter from Selznick to Hitchcock after Hitchcock sent him his first draft of the screenplay. So Hitchcock wrote a draft of the screenplay, and this is, I'm just going to read you the first two paragraphs of this letter, because it is like a 13-page response about how upset David O. Selznick was for this treatment. So here's just the first two paragraphs of this letter. Dear Hitch, it is my unfortunate and distressing task to tell you that I am shocked and disappointed beyond words by the treatment of Rebecca. I regard it as a distorted and vulgarized version of a provenly successful work in which, for no reason that I can discern, old-fashioned movie scenes have been substituted for the captivatingly charming Du Maurier scenes. This is particularly true in the Riviera sequence. We bought Rebecca, and we intended to make Rebecca. The few million people who have read the book and who worship it would very properly attack us violently for the desecrations which are indicated by the treatment. But quite apart from the feelings of these few million, I have never been able to understand why motion picture people insist upon throwing away something of proven appeal to substitute things of their own creation. It is a form of ego which has very properly drawn upon Hollywood the wrath of the world for many years, and candidly, I'm surprised to discover that the disease has apparently also spread to England.
That feels like an almighty read. And
so
I feel
that was...
it's just like...
That is crazy. Yeah, that is like... That is some intense words to be getting from your new producer that you've just signed a contract with on your first work. Your first draft of your first work.
Oh my
with
god.
Him, hey?
That is like walking in on your first day and going, "Hi, we have some notes about your CV." And just a 13-page document going, "No. No." Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The Breen Office, Hollywood Censorship Board, specifically prohibited any outright hint of a lesbian infatuation or relationship between Mrs. Danvers and Rebecca. Though the film clearly does dwell on Danvers' obsessive memories of her late mistress. The Hollywood Reporter reported in 1944 that Edwina Levine McDonald sued Selznick, Daphne Du Maurier, United Artists, and Doubleday for plagiarism. McDonald claimed that the film Rebecca was stolen from her novel Blind Windows and sought an undisclosed amount of accounting and damages. The complaint was dismissed on January 14, 1948, and the judgment can be read online. Lawrence Kerr, Olivier, was an English actor and director who, along with his contemporaries Ralph Richardson, Peggy Ashcroft, John Gielgud, dominated the British stage of the mid-20th century. He also worked in films throughout his career, playing more than 50 cinema roles. Late in his career, he had considerable success in television roles. His family had no theatrical connections, but Olivier's father, a clergyman, decided that his son should become an actor. After attending a drama school in London, Olivier learned his craft in a succession of acting jobs during the late 1920s. In the 30s, he had his first important West End success in Noel Coward's Private Lives, and he appeared in his first film in 1935. He played in a celebrated production of Romeo and Juliet alongside Gielgud and Ashcroft, and by the end of the decade, he was an established star. In the 40s, together with Richardson and John Burrell, Olivier was the co-director of the Old Vic, building it into a highly respected company. There, his most celebrated roles included Shakespeare's Richard III and Sophocles' Oedipus. In the 1950s, Olivier was an independent actor-manager, but his stage career was in the doldrums until he joined the avant-garde English stage company in 1957 to play the title role in The Entertainer, a part he later played on film. From 1963 to 73, he was a founding director of Britain's National Theatre, running a resident company that fostered many future stars. His own parts there included the title role in Othello and Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. Among Olivier's films are Wuthering Heights from 39, Rebecca, and a trilogy of Shakespeare films as actor-director, Henry V, Hamlet, and Richard III. His later films include The Shoes of the Fisherman, Sleuth, Marathon Man, and The Boys from Brazil. Olivier's honors included a knighthood in 1947, a life peerage in 1970, and the Order of Merit in 81. For his on-screen work, he received 4 Academy Awards, 2 British Academy Film Awards, 5 Emmys, 3 Golden Globe Awards. The National Theatre's largest auditorium is named in his honor, and he is commemorated in the Laurence Olivier Awards given annually by the Society of London Theatre. He was married 3 times to the actress Jill Esmond, Vivian Leigh, and Joan Plowright. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. Joan de Beauvoir de Havilland, I hope I said that right, known professionally as Joan Fontaine, was a British-American actress. She was best known for her starring roles in cinema during classical Hollywood era. Fontaine appeared in more than 45 feature films in a career that spanned 5 decades. She's the younger sister of actress Olivia de Havilland. Born in Tokyo, Fontaine moved to California before she was 2 years old. She traveled there along with her mother, Lillian Fontaine, and her sisters, following her parents' divorce. She was an anemic child, and her childhood was consequently marred by poor health, but she had improved by her teen years. After living in Japan and attending school there for a short while, she began a stage career in 35, signing a film contract with RKO Pictures. Fontaine received her first major role in The Man Who Found Himself in 1937. Her career prospects improved greatly after starring in Rebecca, for which she received the first of what would be 3 nominations for the Academy Award for Best Actress. The following year, she won her role for Suspicion, and a 3rd Oscar nomination came with the film The Constant Nymph. She appeared mostly in drama films throughout the 40s, including Letter from an Unknown Woman, which is now considered a classic. In the next decade, her film career began to decline, and she moved into stage, radio, and television roles. She appeared in fewer films into the 60s, and her final film was the feature film The Witches in 1966. She released an autobiography, No Bed of Roses, in 1978, and she continued to act until her last performance in 1994. This is, we will see her one more time in Suspicion. George Henry Sanders was a British film and television actor, singer, songwriter, music composer, and author. His career as an actor spanned over 40 years. His upper-class English accent and bass voice often led to him being cast as a sophisticated but villainous characters. He's perhaps best known as Jack Favell in Rebecca, Scott Foliot in Foreign Correspondent, Addison DeWitt in All About Eve, Sir Brian de Bois-Guilbert, I'm terrible at names, in Ivanhoe, King Richard the Lionheart in King Richard and the Crusaders, and Mr. Freeze in the two-part episode of Batman. We will see Sanders again in Foreign Correspondent, and interestingly, Sanders appeared in a 1944 version of The Lodger. Dame Frances Margaret Anderson, known professionally as Judith Anderson, was an Australian-born British actress who had a successful career in stage, film, and television. A preeminent stage actress in her era, she won two Emmy Awards and a Tony Award, and was also nominated for a Grammy Award and an Academy Award. She is considered one of the 20th century's greatest classical stage actors. She made her Broadway debut in Up the Stairs in 1922, followed by The Crooked Square in 1923. She went to Chicago with Patches in 1923 and appeared in Peter Weston, which only had a short run. 1 year later, she changed her acting forename to Judith and had her first triumph with the play Cobra, starring Louise Calhern, which ran for 35 performances. Anderson then went on to The Dove, which went for 101 performances and really established her on Broadway. She toured Australia in 1927 with three plays, Tea for Three, The Green Hat, and Cobra. Back on Broadway, she was in Behold the Bridegroom by George Kelly and had the lead role in Anna. She replaced Lynn Fontaine during the successful run of Strange Interlude. Anderson made her film debut in a short for Warner Brothers called Madam of the Jury. In 1931, she played the unknown woman in the American premiere of Pirandello's As You Desire Me, filmed the following year with Greta Garbo in the same role. It ran for 142 performances. She was in the short-lived revival of Morning Becomes Electra, and then did Firebird. She made her feature film debut with a role in Blood Money, and Anderson focused on Broadway, but this is her only Hitchcock appearance. Now, last but not least, the Hitchcock cameo comes at 2 hours, 6 minutes, and 57 seconds into the film. Hitchcock is walking near the phone booth just after George Sanders makes a phone call. And that is my extensive trivia. Thank you guys for bearing with me. I appreciate it. Okay, so the first thing that I want to talk about with this movie is the Battle of the Behemoths here. You know, we're Hitchcock's coming to America. He's making this film. He gets a contract with David O. Selznick. And David O. Selznick is like this massive movie producer that doesn't like to give up control. So you look at a movie like this, right? And I was reading in The Art of Alfred Hitchcock by Donald Spotto, and even in here he says, "It's hard to reflect on Rebecca as if it were a Hitchcock film. The production values were entirely Selznick's, the crew was Selznick's, the casting was entirely overseen by Selznick, but there are a few remarkable visual touches which, because we see them in other films by the director pre- and post-Rebecca, enable us to locate some of his particular contributions." So it's like, it's really interesting because it's like, where does this film fit? How much is this Hitchcock and how much is this Selznick? What do you guys think? Manish, let's start with you.
You know, it's kind of hard to like make that distinction, right? Because none of us were really there when it was being made. And the novel itself is very Hitchcockian. You know, so it's like, even if you want to, you know, make a very faithful adaptation, it's still going to have that, a lot of those Hitchcock touches, you know, like a movie like Notorious or Spellbound or, even like Marnie or something, where it's like, you know, you have these like troubled heroines and, you know, large houses and, you know, a lot of intrigue. So, I think it's hard to tell. I mean, I think a lot of the visual aesthetic of the film is pure Hitchcock. So even if, you know, narratively he was kind of stuck, you know, with what, you know, with being close to the novel, it's like, I still think that the filmmaking itself is very much something that he would, it's very much of the, you know, the aesthetic that he would, continue to work in, especially in this 1940s period.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what do you think?
I mean, as someone who was there, because I am an ageless creature with the with the body of a swan made of buttercream, I can say it was probably... No. as if anyone who's listening is going to be serious. The other thing I can think of, and it sounds a bit daft, but it's almost like what's happening with the MCU at the moment, in the sense of you have these directors, you have these creators who are brought on to execute a certain vision. Okay, it's this superhero, it's this sort of thing. But it's all overseen by Kevin Feige, who is the kind of head honcho, creative director, one of the most important people in the industry. And as much as those directors and writers try and put their own stamp on it and their own flavour and their own, you know, colour, it still has to fit into this patchwork kind of canvas, really. You know, so you know, for example, look at the biggest film of the year so far, which is Avengers Endgame. It's a very well-made film, it's that sort of thing. I could not tell you what one visual flourish is that makes it a Russo Brothers film. I honestly could not tell you what... Whereas, if you look at, say, Rebecca, there's a lot that I think still really matches up with the overall white kind of Hitchcock canon, in the sense of you do get those fantastic kind of shots. There is a lot of almost dark melodrama. There is a mystery at the heart of it, because it's not just, you know, who was Rebecca? It then becomes, you know, how did she die when the body's discovered and there's the boat? And then it's like, okay, how did she die? And, you know, what was the secret behind it? That sort of thing. And Hitchcock loves a good mystery and he loves a good story. I can concede that there was a lot of creative impulses taken out from him. And I don't know whether this is kind of indicative of his time in early Hollywood, because as we know, he gained much more creative control as he ventured kind of into the late 40s and the early 50s. So I don't know if in the films to come we'll see that persist, or we'll see if, you know, he has to keep certain actors, even if he doesn't like them, or he has to do certain things, even if he doesn't agree with them, that sort of thing. But I, like you said, because they're two behemoths, because they're two titans of film, you know, you've got such a popular, at the time, still sort of up-and-coming or, you know, well-established director who's only just beginning to venture into Hollywood. And then you've got Selznick, who's, you know, in 1940, he's coming off the back of the, still to this day, the highest-grossing film of all time. So, I can imagine there was a lot of ego. You know, you mentioned the 13-page, and you read part of it out, the 13-page kind of memo that basically... I mean, because I'm sure a lot of it was genuine critique, but it could also have been a bit of a territorial stamp where he was going like, right, okay, I know you're this and you're the director, but this is my show. You know, I'm the ringmaster of this particular circus, so please don't start thinking you're going to create something that isn't going to match up.
See, when I was thinking about this movie, you know, another producer that I was thinking of who kind of, you know, had creative control over his films that made me think of this was George Lucas for Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Right? Because he didn't direct those, but he really heavily influenced the direction of those movies. Right? Like, to the point where, like, a lot of people are like, did even Richard Marquand even really do that much for Return of the Jedi? Right now, I don't know the history about that. I just know a little bit about it, so I could be talking out of the side of my hat here. Right?
I mean, I think I'm not a big Star Wars fan. I enjoy them, but I'm not a diehard Star Wars fan.
How do I hang up this
game? I know, right?
Listen, I like the films. I'm just not the person who's like, oh yes, I've read every extended universe thing, or, you know, so on and so forth. But I've read in interviews somewhere, and I have to agree, is that you look at the original trilogy and you look how Lucas worked with, you know, the directors and all that sort of thing, and I think it's that balance that makes them so good. And then you look at, for example, the prequel trilogy, which, you know, I think it's not cruel to say they are regarded less favourably. You know, I think they're fine. I don't have a problem with them, but a lot of people don't think they're as good as the original trilogy, and that's fine. And I think a lot of people attribute that to the fact that George Lucas was directing and had complete and full creative control that went unchecked.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, people wouldn't even tell him to stop.
You know, so a lot, and you know, that's what's interesting now. And again, swinging back around to the sequel trilogy, you know, we've got the last one coming out around about Christmas time this year, is seeing what creative control has been like for this particular kind of trilogy of movies, because there's been plenty of drama behind the scenes of, you know, directors going and coming and, you know, people's opinions on The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi and all that sort of thing. So it's interesting, and I agree with the kind of George Lucas comparison, but almost maybe the other way around. I would have been very interested to see what exactly, and I don't know if it exists somewhere, what Hitch's original script for Rebecca would be like and how it compares. Because if it's so different, I'm like, what did he do?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, I was reading somewhere that David O. Selznick was very keen on staying faithful to the novel and kind of exerting his creative control because of the success of Gone with the Wind, as you mentioned. And I mean, the thing is, like, at that time, like, I think he was, in a way, right, because, you know, Gone with the Wind was a very faithful adaptation, and I think he would be afraid that, you know, if Rebecca strayed too far from, you know, the novel, then people would kind of reject the film, which is something that I actually think happens today. I mean, nowadays, I think that, like, there's a movie that's made from a book that changes a lot of the, you know, the narrative beats, characters, whatever, I think people will get angry about that. And it's still hard, I think, for people to kind of separate the two. So, separate the two mediums. So, I think it's, in a way, like, he and Hitchcock are kind of, like, perfectly matched, because they're both, you know, huge egos and, you know, power hungry. So I'm sure it was not a pleasurable experience, but I think, you know, together the two of them, like, working in tandem, you know, it made this really, really great film. So
it's completely right what you're saying, and it sort of works with the power dynamic, because if one of them had been not weaker, but so, like, less experienced, or they were kind of more likely to bend, then it might have ended up in a very different product, or that kind of thing. So it probably is a decent balance of what Selznick wanted with his kind of producer hat on, and then also what Hitchcock wanted to do in creating this kind of gothic, dark, kind of psychological drama thriller.
Have you guys read the novel by any chance?
Yes.
No.
So I didn't read it, but I listened to an audiobook narrated by Anna Massey, who is in Frenzy.
Oh, I love her.
And, I mean, unfortunately, she passed away a number of years ago, but she, I mean, her narration was just so perfect. I mean, she's such a great voice for it. I really enjoyed the book a lot. I guess maybe because I had seen the film first, and I had seen, I'd seen the movie first. I've seen the movie a number of times. So a lot of the things that were different from the film, I almost preferred, you know, the film version, except for, you know, the kind of the big twist in the end.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, we can talk about that in a bit, but yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed the book. I thought it was very gripping and intense.
Yeah. Okay, for 2 points. One, yes, Anna Massey's voice. I could just listen to it all the time. She has the best voice. Rest in peace, Anna Massey. You're awesome.
Yeah, but is it as good as Werner Herzog's voice?
I don't know who that is. Who's Werner Herzog?
Werner Herzog voices like that to me. I love his voice. His voice, he's got a German accent, but it's like, it's, I love his voice. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. I'm just going to Google that and probably put ASMR after it and be like, cool, let's see what this is. But yeah, so Anna Massey, awesome. Love her voice. Anyway, second point, I agree, but I did it backwards, or I did it book then film, because basically, if you're, unless you're in the UK, basically there's 2 years where you do A levels, and that's basically like a mini college before you go off to university. So you do either A levels or BTECs, and it's just a kind of a focused qualification on certain subjects, and you get to pick your topics and all that sort of thing, and it usually helps you take those and get into, you know, university of your choice. For mine, about 10 years ago, I did English Lit, and one of the books that we did for kind of Gothic literature was Rebecca, and I did it as a comparison alongside Dracula with regards to feminism and horror and all that sort of thing. So I read the book, and then when I was getting into Hitchcock, I went, oh, there's a Hitchcock version, and just watched it then, got it on DVD cheap somewhere. So for me, it's, I love and appreciate the film, and I think there are some bits that I think are just a bit more fun in the film than in the book, but I love, and you've said it, we'll mention it later, and obviously spoilers and everything, the twist in the book I think is handled much better and is much truer to the character than what they have to do in the film. But then if you consider the film, they had to, you know, the codes and everything they had to do. So,
well, we can jump to that, but before we jump to that, I will say that as well, one of the letters in here is David O. Selznick writing to, I think, one of his assistants or something like that, and he's like, listen, I need you to talk to Daphne du Maurier and let her know that we changed the ending of this, not by choice, but because we were forced to, so that she doesn't think we're complete and total morons when she reads the screenplay, right? We tried to, but they wouldn't let us because of the code. And I agree. I this movie makes so much more sense when he kills his wife. And, you know, it's leading up to that in the movie. And then when he's like, she tripped and fell, it's like, huh. Okay. So, I don't know if you want to talk about the change. I agree he should kill his wife. And even though they do it in the movie, you know, which it makes sense. Like, if all she did was die, then why would he want to kill himself in the beginning of the movie? Right? Like, why would he want to commit suicide over her accidental death when he hated her? I don't know. So, go.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, it's more interesting to me to have her manipulate him into murdering her, you know, as a means of, like, you know, some, like, suicide by proxy. I don't know if that's a term, but that to me is very interesting and makes Rebecca herself a more, you know, visceral character versus this, like, kind of contrived thing of accidentally killing her and stuff. And yeah, and, like, also, you know, in the novel, when Maxim reveals to his wife, his second wife, that he killed Rebecca, you know, she kind of reacts and just, like, oh my god, thank god he loves me and not her. Like, she's not at all concerned that he, like, murdered his wife.
Right.
And that to me is a much more interesting kind of psychological insight into this narrator, because you can appreciate her sort of neurosis as someone who's kind of desperately clinging to this guy and trying to essentially learn where she stands with him. I mean, they're married, but she feels very, you know, very conflicted about, you know, whether what his feelings are towards her and whether he's just, you know, whether she just is a placeholder for this other wife. And so, you know, it's interesting to me that, you know, she can easily look past the murder and just say, like, oh, okay, this is proof that he loves me. That's a much more fascinating, you know, character beat than, you know, I mean, Joan Fontaine, who I think is a kind of incredible actress, I think she kind of plays she plays that scene as it's like written in the book, and you can kind of like, it's almost as if everything is the same except for, you know, that one detail. And so, like, I think she, in my opinion, she kind of pulls off that kind of tricky, you know, piece of acting of kind of be more so being glad that, you know, Maxim loves her than afraid that, you know, he killed his wife. I think she pulls off that kind of that trick pretty well, despite the fact that, like, you know, the actual story was changed.
Joan Fontaine is fantastic in this movie, and I can't believe that she didn't win the Academy Award. I didn't look up to see who did in this year.
But... yeah, it was Ginger Rogers for a film called Kitty Foyle, which I ended up seeing because I was so curious as to, like, who won over Joan Fontaine in this incredible performance. And, I mean, Ginger, it's... I mean, that film is very much a kind of, like, romantic drama, and, like, so it's not this kind of, you know, haunting, you know, gothic performance. But, I mean, I personally would have given it to Joan Fontaine over Ginger Rogers, but I can see how that... I can see how that's an Oscar-winning performance as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the whole thing, like, just the way that she speaks, the way that she's so timid and, like, uncomfortable, you know, like, she really, really pulls it off the whole time. And, you know... everything that happens in this marriage is all Maxim's fault, right? Like, the way that the guy talks and whatnot, like, you got a relationship like this, you've got to talk to your wife about what's going on. So all this I blame on Maxim. It's all Maxim's fault. Everything that happened. Because if he would have told her, you know, at the beginning, even just like, look, you know, we had this relationship and it wasn't that good, then she wouldn't have tried to live up to that Rebecca name. She wouldn't have tried to have these parties, you know, and then they never would have found the boat and everybody would
have. I mean, I can see that point. However, I think that, you know, in the film, he's always saying how he likes that she's so innocent and naive. And I think he didn't want to bring her into this. Like, he didn't even want the spirit of Rebecca to even, like, taint his new wife in a way. Like, he just wanted to keep her. I agree that it's probably a mistake on his part, but I can understand how he would want to even just keep her in the dark and just keep her as she is, as the sort of opposite, you know, opposite woman from Rebecca.
Mm-hmm. It just ties into a few things you've been talking about, but I really enjoy... and the film does back this up, and I think it's great, and that really does tie into the book, is how it's all related to the themes of agency versus passivity. In the sense of, you know, you pit the two female characters against each other. You have Rebecca versus the second Mrs. De Winter, and they're both complete opposites. In the sense of, you know, Rebecca is... yeah, well, actually, starting with the second Mrs. De Winter, she's so passive. She so lacks any agency. You know, when we meet her, she is a governess, and she's just, you know, being told what to do. And she kind of takes, if not comfort, then she's like, oh, okay, I know what I'm doing with this. This is fine. You know, when Maxim joins up, she's immediately like, yep, okay. You know, I want to do this. I want to please you. That sort of thing, which is fine, but it makes for an initially passive character. She's so used to, and throughout the film, she just reacts. You know, she reacts to what Max tells her to do. She reacts to what the woman in the beginning, I think it's Mrs. Van Horn or something, tells her what to do. She reacts to what Mrs. Danvers tells her to do. She never actually instigates anything herself. She's always been manipulated and that sort of thing. Even the fact that she doesn't have a name is... kind of her completely giving over to this other person, completely giving over to, hey, you know, you don't need a name, you know, you've literally given your name to become just the second Mrs. De Winter. Whereas you look at Rebecca and she dominates, she completely just takes over in a really powerful way. You know, it's stated by multiple characters that, oh yeah, she did what she liked, she didn't give a shit, and she was doing this and that, and to the point where, you know, her name is the title of the book. She literally takes over the name of the story and makes it all about her. It could have been called Manderley, but no, it's Rebecca, because even when she's dead, she is still the main focus and the drive and the thing that anchors the entire story. So you do get the whole thing about two women pitted against each other. You do get a bit of this weird Madonna whore complex thing. But then you also get, you know, this incredible... And for me, it's not so much... incredible is probably a strong word, but I just really enjoyed the incredibly toxic relationship at the heart of it, which is Rebecca and Mrs. Danvers' relationship. So there's that gorgeous scene in the middle of the film where, you know, the new Mrs. De Winters goes investigating and she finds Rebecca's bedroom, mm-hmm. and Danvers walks in and she shows around it and it's so gorgeously messed up. She's going around showing her, like, so proud and being like, oh yes, it's beautiful, isn't it? It's the most perfect room you ever saw. And it is basically code for, like, a lesbian relationship, or at least a lesbian infatuation. Mm-hmm. But it's done so darkly. And it reminds me a lot of, or it might have been inspired the other way around, of, if anyone's seen Guillermo del Toro's Crimson Peak?
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Have you guys seen it? So, it's basically this Victorian Gothic, not even really horror, it's more like a kind of period piece that has the odd supernatural element thrown into it, but it's about a toxic relationship, and it's about, you know, going to this ancestral home that has, you know, a toxic female figure in it, and trying to escape, or trying to make sense of what's going on. So, it's really fantastic in that way. So as much as we kind of go, oh yes, well, Rebecca was this and Rebecca was that, I love Mrs. Danvers because I think she's the only character, or the only female character in the film, who has agency and is actually there, because Mrs. De Winter, the new Mrs. De Winter, doesn't. She just reacts, and Rebecca's dead, even though she is. So I have a bit of a soft spot for Mrs. Danvers. She just floats around, and she's all, you know, she appears in silhouette, and she is like a Disney villain, and I love it.
Yeah. Oh,
it's
actually,
so
up top.
Yeah.
It's a very good comparison. So yeah, like, let's talk about that, because Chris, you and I have talked before on the show. Like, I'm pretty naive when it comes to, like, subtleties of filmmaking, and some of these Hitchcock films I haven't seen in quite a long time. We've talked about Rope, in how I'm like, I don't know, I never realized that was, like, a subtle gay relationship on screen, and I haven't actually seen it since I found that out. And this is the first time I've seen Rebecca since I've heard people talk about Mrs. Danvers and Rebecca in this way. Yeah. And I'm like, so, you know, the naive youth who's seen this movie in previous years has just been like, this is just some form of extreme loyalty of, like, because Rebecca has this extreme presence. And I mean, like, I guess now that I'm older, I know about other things like, you know, bisexuality and LGBTQ+ and whatnot. But I'm like, I never would have seen a lesbian relationship because she's married to a man. Plus she's in love with her cousin, right? You know, in the movie and whatnot. So to me, this is kind of the first time that I've seen the movie since I've been reading about this subtle, you know, can't have this hint of this relationship, even though, yeah, it is kind of strongly, it is there. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it doesn't appear a huge amount in kind of the Hitchcock canon, but there are hints of kind of LGBT, of homosexual relationships, you know, like you said, we've mentioned Rope, and when we do that, we'll talk more about that, and, you know, kind of the queerness that was in 1920s and 1930s films that did get erased as the Hays Code and all the other codes kind of rolled in. So it is interesting. Like, I didn't pick up on it the first time. I wasn't there being like, oh, a gay revelation has occurred. You know, I was telling you guys before, I mean, now that I'm aware, I literally wrote in my notebook, I was like, Rebecca, and then just in black pen, big gay thoughts. Because, you know, I've seen it and I've read it now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not super over, and it wouldn't be for the time anyway. You know, you have, at the time, there was a real dearth of kind of LGBT literature that was actually readily available. So you look at stuff like E.M. Foster's Morris, which is about homosexuality and that sort of thing. He wrote that in the 1910s, and it didn't get published or widely released until the 1940s and 1950s, and even then, it was very much still an underground book. You know, you look at Patricia Highsmith, one of the best kind of suspense and thriller writers, and she wrote you know, Carol, which is a great a lesbian love story and that sort of thing. But even that, that was very much kind of got shunted away into Pulp Fiction. So when you look at the original Rebecca, you know, you do have Mrs. Danvers as this kind of like a gothic villain kind of Dracula figure who's haunting, you know, Manderley, being like, oh yes, you can't go into there because, you know, the ghost of Rebecca lives there. And it's like Carmilla, it's like one of the old Victorian gothic horrors where there's a vampire or a ghoul or something lurking nearby. But, you know, as you start to read into it and you go, oh, okay, it could easily be mistaken for she was almost brainwashed by her. She was almost entranced. She was, you know, made to feel completely besotted, like she was a sort of one-woman cult.
Mm.
But I think people do take it for that. And I think the film actually sort of helps reinforce that, because if you look at the way that it's treated in the film, and it's done subtly, and credit to Hitchcock and to Selznick, you know, like scenes in the bedroom, or like when, you know, there's the, when she's introduced and all that sort of thing, it's so played up as, oh yes, you know, she could never do anything wrong, she could never, you know, do this or that. And, you know, at the end of the film, she's aware of what Rebecca's decision was, which was like, oh, she'd never let anyone, you know, decide what she was going to do. So she knew that she was dying. And knew, oh yes, I knew she'd manipulate her way out and all that sort of thing. So it's this weird intimacy that's almost beyond something as, not mundane, but something as physical as sex. You know, it's this haunting relationship that literally carries into the grave, as we see in the finale. So I don't think it's a particularly positive LGBT relationship, because we don't even get confirmation really that Rebecca and Danvers ever really did anything. It could be Danvers had a big old gay crush and just kind of harbored it, and Rebecca thought, oh, okay, I'll keep this going because Danvers is very useful to me, and I'll just kind of keep it, you know, going, as it were. Or if there was a relationship, or if there was something else, we don't know. And I think that's kind of the beauty and the power of it, in that so much of it is left up to speculation, you know. And in the film, we know more about Danvers in the book. We don't know that much about her from the film, where it's kind of like, oh no, she just came with Manderley to Manderley with Rebecca, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, I always kind of think back to the scene in Rebecca's wink of Manderley, and, you know, with Mrs. Danvers showing the second Mrs. De Winter, you know, Rebecca's clothes, and especially her, like, lingerie and the hairbrush. And to me, like, that always felt to be a more more intimate familiarity with Rebecca's things than, you know, perhaps a normal housekeeper would have. And so, like, while, you know, of course, like, we don't know Rebecca's, you know, sexual orientation. You know, she just seemed like someone who liked to play with people and manipulate them. So, you know, even, I mean, according to Mrs. Danvers, like, there's that kind of famous scene where she's like, you know, Rebecca would rock with laughter at the lot of you and stuff. So I always felt like, even if she is, you know, having an affair with, you know, her cousin, which is something that, no, I mean, I don't know if cousin is just like a colloquial term for like family friend, or if it's actually her cousin. But I feel like no one seems to be fazed by that.
I think it is her actual cousin, and I don't think it's really that fussed.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they are like rich people in the 1930s.
I don't know. Like, we got The Godfather 3. We talked about that on my other podcast. That, like, you know, Sofia Coppola's character, whatever her name is, she's like in love with her cousin too. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, this is just movies, right?
So yeah, in British society, there is. There was quite a lot of cousin marriage. That's why all of our food, but the food's bad. All the inbreeding has made the taste buds go. So,
Yeah, I would too, but I don't know what to say about that. Like, what do we make of that? It's her cousin. It is weird that it's her cousin to me, but it's like,
I just think that she was just, you know, just manipulative and sadistic, and just, you know, easily charming to people on the outside. So I can imagine her having this, you know, I mean, not to, I mean, I guess, you know, between the two of them, they could just have this sort of like sick, toxic relationship, you know, and that just seems like, you know, I don't want to say forbidden, because even that sounds too like romantic for it, but just has this like
taboo.
I think it just is goes to show like Rebecca is truly an, you know, she truly was an evil person with a lot of secrets, and having an incestuous affair is just another sign of her, you know, depraved nature.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like this person, you know, like Rebecca is such a perfect name for this movie and this book. Because the they're talking about this character all the time, and it's, you know, it's one of those roles, like if Rebecca ever did show up in this film, it'd be one of those roles that actors love, because they're constantly talking about the character before the character shows up. But, you know, in this movie, the character never shows up. They're just talking about her the whole time, you know, and she is such an overpowering character. But, you know, you had said earlier, Manish, that it could have been called, I think it was you that said it, that this could have been called Manderley. Right, that would have been also another appropriate name, because that house is such an overpowering figure in it as well. You know, like some of the special features talk about how this was a miniature, and some really interesting ways that they filmed this. But you know, like this is this massive, massive home that De Winter lives in, this overpowering home, and she, you know, Mrs. De Winter feels really out of place when she's there. There's so many servants. You know, he's got such a large property. There's this boathouse down there and everything. Like, it's just this massive, massive property. So let's talk about this other behemoth character that's in the movie.
I love Manderley, and I, like, would love to I would love to visit it if it were, like, a real place. I know it's kind of based off a few estates in... Cornwall or
yeah,
Cornwall, yeah,
yeah. So I'm sure there is
right next
like
to Jamaica
it.
Inn, right, Chris?
Yeah,
it's just on the road. That's why the fire is going like, oh bloody hell, there's the lighthouse. And like, nope, no, that's just a different story. Go away. Go
on. Yeah, that's also based off a De Maurier novel. Correct?
Yes, it is. Yes,
yeah. So, but yeah, like one of my favorite kind of genre film is like these sort of like gothic romance, gothic horror films. And especially when they have these like kind of frail, waifish young women kind of running around like a big creaky house. So like a movie like this and like Crimson Peak and The Innocents, like I love all that. And the others is like with Nicole Kidman, like all these films like that I really enjoy. And so, like, Manderley feels like such a mythical place in the beginning. Like, you know, when they're in Monte Carlo with Mrs. Van Hopper, and just the way that, you know, just the way that she speaks of, you know, Maxim and Manderley, and the way that, you know, Hitchcock frames, you know, frames the scenes and with the editing and blocking and yeah, and like I just really love this idea about this place that means so much to all these people, like in their little town and or in, you know, in like within their kind of high society. You know, Manderley is like lots of parties and glamour and, you know, wealthy people being extravagant, but it houses all these secrets and, you know, and murder and, you know, stuff like that. So I really love the house and, you know, just like the way that it's, you know, designed, within the film, like with the, I always take note of the doorknobs being at eye level. Because it really dwarfs Joan Fontaine and makes her seem so out of place. And a lot of that also has to do with kind of her like neurotic, kind of nervy performance, paranoid as well. And yeah, I mean, it feels like a place with a lot of history that can just feel very oppressive while also being this very beautiful estate.
Yeah, a couple of points. First of which, Manish, if you haven't seen... Have you seen The Awakening?
I have not, actually. No.
It's that kind of spooky shit. I think you'll
okay,
like it.
Okay, yeah, I need to watch that.
It's not quite like Wake with a Candlestick kind of stuff, but it is about a woman who goes to investigate ghosts at a haunted boarding school, and it's the same energy. And I think it's you'll like it.
Amazing. Yeah. Can't wait to watch it.
Definitely. Secondly... I really enjoy the location. I think it gives off this very specific, and the only way I can describe it is it's this kind of Shirley Jackson-ish energy. Like, We Have Always Lived in the Castle, or The Sundial, or I'm trying to think, what's the famous one? The Haunting of Hill House, where they're these stories that are so focused on these dark, oppressive, kind of rooted, ancient buildings. I'm trying to find the best way to describe it. That, you know, it's almost like they just sort of retain every negative thing that's been stored in them. You know, because in the book they do mention kind of the history of Mandalay a little bit. You know, it comes from various bits and pieces, that sort of thing. But it is a character in itself. It is this kind of imposing edifice. And in a way, it's very much tied to Rebecca. You know, she who... It isn't her home, it's Max's, but somehow she made it her own to the point where when the mystery of her death is resolved, it's almost like the house has to go with her. You know, it's her last kind of remaining foothold on in the world, you know, because they never found, you know, they don't find her body until the boat washes up, you know.
Yeah.
They don't find out the mystery until it all comes out with the doctor and it's discovered, oh, well, she knew she had what you'd call kind of uterine or ovarian cancer and she knew she was going to die, so she took it into her own hands. So, and it is very wrapped up in the sense of, you know, oh, we don't talk about the West Wing. Because that's where she lived, and that's where her rooms are. And that's where the final shots of the film are. And honest to God, it took me so long in that last shot to realise it was an R. I was there focusing, going like, why are they zooming in on this one thing? And it just, it took me so long.
I guess that was subtle enough for Hitchcock then. We couldn't even make it out.
I mean, if they'd have gone with the original plan and had a giant... are made of smoke, maybe I'd have got it sooner, but
yeah.
Let me ask you guys, like, does the mansion burn down in the book?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, go ahead. You can.
Okay. No, I was gonna say, so yes, it does burn down, but the finale is different. So Second Mrs. De Winter is basically with Max on the drive up, and it's kind of like, oh, we've resolved, we're going to drive into a bright future, that sort of thing, and then they see smoke on the horizon, and it's as they drive up that they see it's basically in flames, and that's sort of how the book ends. And so Mrs. Danvers is never actually kind of blamed or made culpable, but it is strongly hinted.
It's kind of like implied that she did it, but it doesn't state explicitly that she did it. Unlike in the film, which shows her, you know, lighting the fire.
Yeah. It literally shows her just sort of like dancing in the flames almost and kind of and then getting absolutely crushed to bits with debris. So like, okay.
Because in the movie, it's like revenge from Mrs. Danvers because Maxim's getting off and gonna live happily ever after with this woman. But in the book, if he killed her, did he get away free in the book? Because maybe he did.
Yeah,
because that's why they changed the ending.
It's essentially like it's the same in the film, right? Like it's ruled a suicide because you know they visit Dr. Baker and he reveals that she had cancer, and basically
she didn't have cancer in the book, though, did she?
She
was
pregnant. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So that wasn't changed.
Yeah. The only thing that's different is that Maxim like straight murders her in the novel
for telling him she was pregnant with this other guy's kid.
Yeah, that happens as well. So they think that basically in the novel, they go to see the doctor Baker, and Maxim and the second wife are like afraid that he'll reveal that she's pregnant, and then that will implicate Maxim.
Mm-hmm.
But in the novel, it's in the novel, they go there, and yeah, he basically reveals that she had cancer, and he's like, a lot of people, I think he says that Rebecca was afraid of, you know, dying slowly, so she is likely to have committed suicide just to have a quick death, and then that's enough for the inspector.
Okay.
So they just rule it a suicide, but. Yeah, I mean, the novel kind of stretches why the second wife would go with them through all this, because it's, you know, it's a first-person narrative. So in the movie, at least, like, because, you know, it's kind of omniscient, it's not that contrived that, like, she would stay back. Mm. Yeah.
Cool. Okay, excellent. Right on. Well, we've kind of hit just about everything on here. Manish, is there anything we haven't talked about yet that you'd like to address?
I wanted to get your opinions on, like, a couple of the scenes. Like, we hardly talked about, like, the kind of the first act of the film in Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
Which is, a part of the film that I've kind of grown to really appreciate. I used to find it kind of like, well, whatever, let's just get to it, you know, because, like, the movie starts with the kind of iconic, you know, last night I dreamt I went to Mandalay again and all that. And then it just kind of switches to this, like, very, like, rushed romance. But I've grown to appreciate it more and more as I watch it, as this, a lot of the scenes are kind of coded in this kind of dread of just, you know, like, you kind of know that something will be happening with Maxim. He's, you know, Laurence Olivier is very brooding and dangerous in his attractiveness. So I just want to get your opinions on those, you know, scenes in the beginning.
Chris, do you want to go first?
I mean, I was just thinking about, because I'm not into Laurence Olivier in this, but I think it was 1935, he did Pride and Prejudice. And that was like, I was like, okay, I get it now. No, like the first act when they're in Monte Carlo and it's kind of the grand European journey and all that sort of thing. It does its job, but it sets up the characters pretty well. Even though, you know, you have the protagonist, you know, the second Mrs. De Winter, even though she hasn't got a lot in terms of agency or something like that, you do get her set up really well. You know, she does get to get into the role of this kind of ingenue, this waif who's, you know, not very experienced. She's, like, deliberately set up as a foil to both, you know, Danvers and Rebecca. You know, it lets Hitch, I think, explore a bit in this international playground almost. Because he has obviously done a lot of films where he kind of darts about Europe for a bit. So there's, like, you know, The Lady Vanishes, or there's, you know, all these various films where he does get to kind of journey around a bit. So it is nice that he does get to kind of at least go, okay, if I'm going to be in one location for a fixed amount of time, at least I can do the beginning somewhere a bit more exotic and a bit cooler. And, you know, because sometimes in kind of gothic horror, it starts off being not more boring, but kind of a more stable and quiet opening location that the heroine is plucked from, and, oh, she gets to go to the exciting and mysterious and dark and gothic wherever. Whereas here, you're like, Monte Carlo, this is already plenty exciting, but it's kind of, it's bright where Mandalay is dark. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a lot of kind of excitement, that sort of thing. So I thought that was an interesting dichotomy. I thought, like I said, it set it up really well. You got to set up Max quite well, you know, for both his kind of magnetic qualities and then also for some of his more colder ones. So he has the moment where he's, you know, takes her for a drive and they're talking and he sort of steps very close to the edge and it's just this kind of weird, oh my god, is he gonna, I mean, because we kind of know he's not gonna jump, but we know that there's, you know, something dark and troubled going underneath the surface, so, you know, and that's something that Hitchcock does in a few films, such as, and again in Joe Fontaine's next Hitch film, Suspicion, that happens a couple of times, where it's, you know, the leading man gets to do something really dark, and he gets to, you know, he gets to brood. He gets to be brooding, and he gets to do all that sort of thing. So, I liked it. I thought it worked pretty well in the setting up. It's not as interesting as the rest of the film, but I don't dislike it. You know, it serves a purpose, gets it done, and it manages to look good while doing it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, you know, watching this, I watched the first hour of it with my daughter because I had to put it on late the other night, and she had to go to bed, so she didn't finish it with me. But, you know, watching a movie like this, watching movies with my daughter, I'm made aware of a lot of times when we just go with things in movies and it's hard to explain. Like, my daughter would kept asking, like, why is he making her cry? Why is she crying? Like, at the beginning when they're in the car, and I'm like, well, he kind of talked mean to her, right? He said, you know, he was kind of forceful with her, and, you know, she's like, why is he talking like this to her, and stuff like this. And it's like, it is a weird romance at the start of this movie, but we kind of just go with it as viewers.
Yeah, yeah.
But trying to explain it to an 8-year-old, or I guess she's 9-year-old now, trying to explain it to a 9-year-old is like, yeah, don't go for guys that treat you like this.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know, like, but it's so uncomfortable, their relationship. And again, I put all the blame on it on Maxim, right, as I said earlier in the podcast. But it is an uncomfortable relationship that they have. And, you know, Joan Fontaine is sitting here saying, we have a successful marriage, look at how good it is. And it's like, well, really? Do you really have that successful of a marriage here? Because
I know, but you know what? I've been in relationships like that where you're just trying so hard to make it work. So I really related to her.
Yeah.
Haven't we all just will it into existence and it'll be perfect, you know?
Haven't we all tried to, you know, make a relationship happen just because the other person's quite cute? You're like,
yeah,
it's fine. With sheer willpower, just because they're quite hot, we'll just ignore it.
Yeah.
All the red flags.
But yeah, I did like the stuff in Monte Carlo. I think it was a lot of fun. I loved that Van Hout or whatever her name was. Van Hopper. What an extraordinary character. You know, I think that whole sequence with Joan Fontaine keeping it quiet about who she was actually seeing, and she thought she was going off with this tennis player and whatnot. I really liked that a lot. But, you know, Maxim's relationship with the main character, the woman, is weird and uncomfortable the whole time. But it kind of adds to the uncomfortableness of the movie, so...
Yeah, right. It's like this very neurotic romance. I also wanted to just bring up the scene at the costume party, because that's one of my favorite scenes, because it's just like your heart just goes out to her. This like poor girl who's trying so hard and she just can't make it work. And, you know, shout out to Gladys Cooper as well, playing, you know, Maxim's sister. It's such a fun performance she has. And, I mean, a great character in the book as well. So,
I love that actress. Last couple
things I want to mention.
I love Gladys Cooper. I remember her most from that Twilight Zone episode that she was in with Robert Redford. There's Something in the Dark or Nothing in the Dark or something like that.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I love
great.
That one.
I'm going to watch that tonight. That's a good episode.
she's the old woman hiding and he turns out to be
Death.
You know, who he turned out to be.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that episode.
Yeah,
I remember her in My Fair Lady. She plays Henry Higgins' mom. It's pretty almost like kind of a similar performance as this, where she's just like, cuts men down to size, and it's amazing.
Excellent, right on. Well, Chris, Manish, is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't touched on yet?
The score is lovely.
Well, excellent. The score is really good, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't have much to add. I mean, it's a typical Waxman score of the era, right? I mean, it didn't stand out beyond that. It's good music, but beyond that...
I can't think of anything.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, then, why don't we give this a rating here? Manish, what would you give this rating? Give us a funny rating.
A for always tell your wife that you killed your first wife.
Give it an A for always tell your wife you killed the first one.
Yeah.
Chris, what would you give this movie?
I had something and I don't remember now. I will stick to the 5 out of 5. I will say 5 out of 5 mysterious, possibly lesbian housekeepers who know more than they should.
Yeah, and I'd give it 5 out of 5 silk panties made by nuns. Fair enough. Awesome. Yeah, this movie's a lot of good. I did not like this movie when I originally saw it. I've only seen it twice now. Like, I had the Criterion DVD when it came out. I still have it. And then I did buy the Criterion Blu-ray when it came out, and I finally watched it for the first time. And I don't know. I took a complete turnaround on this movie, and I really, truly loved it this time around. I think it's a fantastic, fantastic film. And it's probably my top Hitchcock film now that we've covered.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I really, really liked this movie a whole heck of a lot. So I was completely captivated watching it last night.
Good. I'm glad.
Yeah. No, it was a whole heck of a lot of fun. Aubrey was really enjoying it. She watched about the first hour, and she's going to go back and watch the rest of it at some point. But, you know, we've shown her a few Hitchcock films, and she's really liked them, So it's fun exposing her to these things. But, awesome.
Some would say introducing, but yeah, exposing works.
Awesome. Manish, where can people find you when you're not, trying to convince people that you're pregnant with your cousin's baby?
I am on Twitter at TheManish89. That's TheManish89. Also at TalkFilmSociety.com, where you can read my writing. I have a column on queer cinema called Real Pride. So check that out, twice a month. And also I host a podcast called It Pod to Be You, which you can find on Twitter and iTunes and, wherever you can find your podcasts. And I invite a guest to chat about romantic comedies for 45 minutes, just, good casual chat about movies we love. And that's always fun. So, please subscribe to that if you'd like. And again, you guys, I'd love to have you on for rom-com, Chris, Brandon, if you guys enjoy romantic comedy, you're welcome to come on anytime.
I have only just watched it When Harry Met Sally.
Oh my god. I mean, that's the classic,
That's the classic. But, yeah. Would you classify The 39 Steps as a rom-com?
I could. I mean, I'm willing to stretch it because it does have some screwball elements to it. And the romance is, a major part of the second half. So, I could allow it,
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us, Manish.
Thank
Welcome
you
back
so
as well.
Much for
anytime.
Having me. It's an absolute pleasure. I love talking to you guys.
Chris, where can people find you when you're not sitting and vacationing in Monte Carlo on the off season?
Well, when am I not? You can find me on Twitter at @Hyatt_boy, where I will pretty much just be chatting and retweeting and doing anything. Apart from Good Evening, I also do a podcast called North by Nerd West, which is me and my best mate Emma Platt just chatting about all kind of nerdy stuff, and that's really fun. We are on iTunes and SoundCloud, so check us out there. I'm also doing a bunch of different shows very soon, so hopefully I'll be on Eccentric Earth, which is Amy Walker's podcast, where guests are introduced to a history topic without knowing what it is in ahead of the recording. So it's always a surprise. It's a lot of fun. So yeah, hopefully check some of those out on my feed. Yeah, that's about it.
Excellent. And our absent co-host, Tom Caldwell, you can find him on Twitter at @TheTomCaldwell. We miss him and wish he could have joined us today, but again, he was under the weather. But he will be back, I'm sure, next time when we cover Foreign Correspondent. My name is Brandon Metella. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. I'm over on Trek FM with a podcast called The Line, which is a Star Trek Picard podcast. And right now we're just doing a few episodes leading up to the new show. And I'm finishing up my run on Warp 5, which is our Star Trek Enterprise podcast. So episode 202 is actually going to be our last episode. I've been saying episode 200 is, but we decided to do a couple more episodes just to flesh out a few things, some low-hanging threads that we wanted to take care of. And I got this, and then I got Franchise Fatigue over on the United Federation of Podcast Network, where my friend Zach and I, we go over a film franchise, all the sequels and remakes in a franchise, and currently we are doing Terminator leading up to Terminator Dark Fate, which I'm so excited for! I'm super excited for that one. Excellent. Thanks so much to the Phantom Podcast Network and the Saskatchewan Podcast Network for all of their support and hosting us. Thank you so much to to Jason Callamore for his wonderful, wonderful theme song. And thank you so much to our friends Annie and Catherine and their podcast, Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents Podcast. Take a look at that one. They are back now after their summer hiatus, covering the episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Again, until next time, when we cover the other film, another film nominated for Best Picture in 1940, Foreign Correspondent. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.